My name is Gary Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs Dispatch, our monthly roundup where we answer your questions, talk about a topic, and read your responses to this month's games.
Yeah. And this one's action-packed, so why don't we jump right into it?
Yeah. Depending on your incredibly mild definition of action. Hold on to your seats.
Every single thing in this world is relative and in context.
Yes.
Compared to staring at a pond.
Yes.
We're about equivalent.
Yeah, it's similar. Listening to a pond.
Yes.
I'm going to start here with Mark. Mark says, I have been playing Baldur's Gate 3 and loving it. Feels like a game worthy of a super zoomed in coverage similar to Bonfireside Chat. If you folks did Baldur's Gate 3 as Bonfireside Chat, I would listen.
Yeah.
Be still my heart. I think that'd be really fun. It would support it so far. There's tons of lore and tons of stuff to talk about, different cultures, lots of like books and back matter and stuff like that. The trick would be audience. Like the audience expects a certain thing. It would be trying to build from the ground up for that, you know, be a little tricky.
It would.
I mean, in a world with unlimited time, I would fucking love to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But in a world where we're already doing Bonfireside Chat, it's kind of hard. It is hard. Yeah.
It just isn't appropriate for Bonfireside Chat.
You end up beating that?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, it's huge. Like, and I'm also being a real completionist. So still working on it, an embarrassing number of hours into it because I've been cramming it into spaces where I can, and I have fought two beholders, and they're badass looking.
Nice.
Every monster in it so far, real good looking.
I love that. Yeah.
It is very good. I love that company.
Larian. Jonathan writes, and there are a few questions in here, so we can maybe pick and choose some of them, saying, I'm jazzed about the positive reception for Baldur's Gate 3 and Larian Studios. I'm excited to dive back into their systems, and I have a shotgun of questions for you regarding character customization and building. Do as many or few as you like. I'll do the first one here. What are your favorite character builds and play styles? When I start this up, I intend to do sorcerer and be real talky.
Yeah. It favors a charisma based character. I did a bard, for similar things. They do the thing that's like one of Larian's tricks where all of your NPCs can be any class. You can respect them as well. So they have canonical ones but if you like a person, but you don't like their class, you can switch them. So you can basically, the reason why that's related is you can build your party around whatever you want to do. You don't have to worry about there being too many casters or too many warriors or whatever.
It's like, I like this person. I want to roll with them, but I do not need to necessarily make a huge mechanical sacrifice to make that happen.
I got rid of the fuckwit mage as quick as possible and respect somebody else.
Right.
So this one I'm playing as a bard. I'm playing as talky. A weird thing that happens in this game is you can talk yourself out of really good fights. And I like the tactics of it so much that I'm purposely kind of tanking a couple conversation roles because I know they'll skip a fight.
Nice.
Which is the highest possible praise I can give on a video game. What tabletop or video games have your favorite character customization systems and why? What's good to customize a person in? Great question.
I mean, like character customization in terms of like building like something really powerful, or character customization in terms of like sculpting a face?
I'm sure this is about build choice given the context of the rest of the conversation or the rest of the question.
This does not apply to CRPGs, but it's close enough, so I'm just going to say it. Final Fantasy Tactics I fucking yeah. love building little dudes in that, rounding out an army, you know, picking like just the limited space for synergies that you can get in there with the job system. I just think it's like the right amount of detail and control and also breakability. I love that.
Yeah. Final Fantasy Tactics is great. That's basically an honorary CRPG. Yeah. At this point, like it is, you know, it doesn't, it's got all the strengths, you know, yeah. of such. Yeah, that one's really good. I like the DOS system a lot, the Divinity Original Sin system quite a bit, with the classless and being able to dip into multi classes for little bits of things you want to do, mm-hmm. Quite a bit.
Yeah. Do we want to do more? Do all these or just
let's save them. Yeah. I don't know if we'll save them for the future, but we don't want to give, yeah. you know, that's kind of a whole topic.
Yeah. That's a whole thing here. Yeah. yeah. What's Karu ask?
Karu says, as somebody who came to you guys through Bonfireside Chat, I'm somewhat obsessed with the Souls game, but I'm taking a short break from the series just to make the return all the better. I was wondering if you guys have played any Souls likes or Souls adjacent games recently that you recommend or maybe warn people away from. Thanks and love for all the great work you guys do.
All of my soul's energy has been wrapped up in, Elden Ring.
Yeah, yeah. What's his
yeah,
name?
That game, you know.
The game we've been talking about for 2 years.
Yeah, Mumbly Joe. Yeah. yeah. I could picture it. Sorry. Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm sleepy. so my standbys are going to be, you know, things I'm going to fall back on. Man, I'm such a fucking mess today. My standbys are going to be something. Anyway, Death's Gambit, I think, is one that I am really champing at the bit to replay.
Me too.
With its big update that it had. Same thing with Blasphemous, Blasphemous 2 coming out. I haven't played the extra content in that. I think that those are both really strong.
Yep. I'm going to throw Grime in the pile.
Oh, shit, yeah.
2D Souls-likes are in a better space right now than 3D ones. Mm-hmm. That may or may not scratch your itch, Karu. Like, playing Aria of Sorrow for the show is reminding me how much those 2D Souls-likes are, to me, kind of like the final evolution of an Igavania. Yeah. You know, like, mm-hmm. I like a Death's Gambit, like, and it's doing a lot of the same things.
Yes.
You know, yeah. For that. In terms of 3D, there's a huge drop off. There are ones mm-hmm. that are fine, you know, fine to good. Like, I like Immortal Unchained, mm-hmm. you know, quite a bit. Remnant has some fun to it. The one where you turn into stone.
Mortal Shell.
I like Mortal Shell, and that's really bite size. That'd be a good one to place with, but you're not going to get the same thing.
Yeah.
And if you're an absolute like combat freak, if like what you want is more and more intricate combat, you could play Wolong, or you could play Neo.
Yeah.
And probably get some joy out of that, because those are more closer to character action stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wilbo Wagons. I'm pretty sure that's not their real name, so I'll just say it. What modern AAA game would you like to remake? Can be made or demade, if you will, with modern sensibilities. I saw a Bloodborne PS1 style demake video on YouTube and thought it looked really rad. I need to play that. And there's a very nice PS about you know, good stuff.
Yeah. Thank you, Wilbo.
Thank you. Man, demakes, that's hard.
Yeah, it's hard to think of something that is currently too polished for me. Like, I always want to see that kind of thing as a curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, like a demake of, say, like the Arkham games that kind of resembled Tenchu a little bit would be interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it would be better, or, you know, that I'd prefer it, or that it would reveal very much new stuff. You know, I think the demakes for me, I like them existing as a demakes channel on YouTube, because it's mostly mm-hmm. just impressive to see.
Yes.
You know, more than anything. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have a real good answer for that.
A Breath of the Wild demake would be really interesting.
Yeah. No, it'd be cool. It would be interesting to see what they did to make exploration a thing and make it not Zelda 1, Zelda 3.
Yeah.
You know, how it would not just be an earlier entry in the series.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I would be curious about that too. Yeah. No definitive answer, sad to say. Matt says, with Baldur's Gate 3 getting glowing reviews, I've started thinking about getting into CRPGs. It's a genre I've never played before. I'm sure I could figure it out. However, I am a console gamer. I know this genre is more optimized for mouse and keyboard. Neither of you have any experience with CRPGs on console? Is the control scheme easy or too much lost in translation? What games are well-tuned for console controller and which are not? Huge strides have been being made in this. I played through Divinity Original Sin 2 on my Switch. And it plays great. You know, it just takes a second to adjust to it. Like, it's not going to play like an action game. You have to make some affordances, but the control scheme is pretty elegant in the end of the day. And that, the basic principles of that have been adapted for those remakes of Baldur's Gate and Planescape and all of those things with varying degrees of success. You know, so a most modern ones, I think, will be fine.
Yeah, it's not going to be like playing Diablo on the PlayStation, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Those days are kind of behind you there. Yeah, I played DOS 2 on PlayStation 4 and was surprised at how well it worked. Yeah. Because it's, I mean, at its heart, not grid-based, but it is similar enough to an XCOM where, you know, it, like, precision and speed doesn't necessarily matter with input.
Yeah. I mean, it's turn-based, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah.
That would be, I would say, most modern things you'd be fine with.
Yeah, yeah. Just if you are looking to get in, I'm sure you probably noticed after you wrote this question, last month's Dispatch topic was all about getting into CRPGs.
Yes. Yeah. And the XCOM comparison will help you. Mm-hmm. They are at their, you know, at their Souls tactics games, generally.
Yeah. Eric writes, "Hi, Cole. Apologies if I missed it elsewhere, but what happened between you and the Devil in Me, fourth, I think, Dark Pictures game? It doesn't sound like you broke up with Dark Pictures entirely, but Devil in Me definitely got too drunk at the party. I thought it had a much better story on average than the other entries, but on replay, I could sense how much padding there was. What was it that soured things for you?" It was that padding. It was kind of the unoriginal Jigsaw style thing and usual, like, the serial killer profiling kind of deal. Felt very uninspired, which is a waste of the H.H. Holmes kind of story, you know, basis for that, I think. And that padding and trying to turn it into a little bit of an Uncharted, like, with, like, you know, block pushing puzzles to get around. That's really bad. It's not block pushing, but, like, you know, pushing stuff so you can climb up and get to places.
Yeah, yeah. Uncharted. Like, yeah. The thing that masquerades as gameplay in Uncharted.
Yes. Yeah. It was just a bad decision. And I thought, you know, like, some of the performances were really good, but other ones were incredibly forgettable. It just felt weaker to me than the first three.
Yeah. Yeah. I still have not played it, but it's good to know what specifically, you know, is to maybe to be avoided. I've got plenty of stuff to play, you know, so maybe someday I'll still play it. I bet you I'd still have fun on the couch playing it with Liv. But at the same time, I don't know. I don't want to push any blocks to climb up with something. Right. I don't do that. Alex says, "Hey guys, new to the show but loving it. I know you guys aren't massive proponents of the get good school of thought, and fair enough, but as a lover of difficult games myself, thanks Super Ghouls and Ghost and obviously the Souls series, where do you think the ideal curve of difficulty versus accessibility lies, and what are some games that really ride that wave? Keep up the great work."
We talk about this quite a bit. In fact, we did early on in the format of the show where we have dispatches. We did a whole episode or a whole topic discussion about difficulty. I think that having a way to kind of make your own Sunday with this, or, you know, multiple ways or more interesting ways than selecting selecting something on a menu, that is, you know, necessary. I think that that is probably the best way to do it, so people can, you know, express themselves by how difficult they make things for themselves with it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The I think what Alex is asking more is what games land on that curve, like, do are just difficult enough, you know, right amount, you know. Part of the question that makes this, or part of the answer to this and the conversation that's difficult, is that gamers ourselves have done that, you know, we've done this before, used accessibility and approachability interchangeably when they're very different things. You know, accessibility does make it a, you know, that's a different thing. than approachability. I don't know. Like, there are lots of hard games that I like. Elden Ring is a perfect difficulty for me. It's hard until the end. Cuphead was a good difficulty for me. There are a couple like big spikes, but ultimately I thought that was a good amount of difficulty. And, you know, I didn't love that as much as some people did, you know, because it's just not my thing so much. But I think that actually was pretty fun, you know, throughout. Good challenge. Yeah. What's another like recent hard game, you know, that hits that balance for you?
I thought Lisa was perfect when it came to difficulty. You know, the fact that the remaster has the additional modes to kind of tailor it is just icing on the cake. You know, like that is harsh to a purpose, it feels like, and ends up making the console RPG style stuff feel more meaningful. Go see that episode for a discussion about that.
Baldur's Gate 3 is treating me well in terms of difficulty as well. It is hard, but good. Demanding.
Nice. Kyle, I think, or Kuil. Sorry. No idea. Says, hey guys, as someone who grew up lower/middle class and went through childhood in the early 2000s, I would get roughly 1 to 2 new games a year for my hand-me-down Game Boy, if I was lucky. This led me to spend a lot of time with Flash and browser games in my youth on various websites back then. Looking back, I have a lot of fond memories playing those games and talking about cool new stuff I'd found with my friends in school. In hindsight, a lot of them were crassly commercial, and navigating the websites that hosted them was like talking through a minefield of ads, walking through a minefield of ads, I believe. Did either of you have much experience with Flash games back in the day? I do think it's very interesting how it's almost like a lost genre of art that is difficult to access and has been usurped by mobile games.
I'm too old for this. Mm-hmm. I missed this. I was online a lot during this period. I played a lot of desktop tower defense at work, at like a job where I could goof off. But sadly, this is not, you know, like a little bit of Rattleskull, but just a little bit of Rattleskull, the game based on Rattleskull or whatever the web animation.
I don't know what Rattleskull is.
It's an old web animation. It's some 2010 nuts stuff. But yeah, I'm sure I played like Pregnancy Launcher or like any number of those things.
Just Angry Birds alike, where you shoot the
that's the thing. Shoot a fetus out of a pussy with the trajectory of like a howitzer as best you can. That was a big genre of these. And then Spider-Man City Raid, my all-time favorite Flash game,
the perfect game.
Yes, 10 out of 10, no notes. But yeah, this did you grow up in this era? Was it a Flash thing?
Yeah. Played plenty of these. Played plenty of extremely racist games in hindsight. Lots of stuff on Newgrounds about Elian Gonzalez.
Oh, boy.
Because that's what got surfaced on the front page. And you're going to poke around and, you know, see stuff, right? It was everything sucked. Yes. I did spend time doing this. Most of my Flash watching was like animation, you know, like just because that was the way you watched videos back in the day before YouTube was ubiquitously available. We played plenty of like little management sims. Had a real fun one that was like you were running like a 3-card Monty stand. You know, and like picking marks and running the game and trying to trick people with it. And you had like a little heat meter. And when your heat got up too high, you had to relocate and like run from the cops in order to reset back up. That was pretty fun.
That sounds sick. Like that sounds really cool.
Yeah. Lots of probably regrettable dating sims. That was how I got my antibodies for that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Just for anybody who's interested in Flash games, the Flashpoint Archive, if you just go to flashpointarchive.org, that is like it's a launcher that will, you don't download everything, but it will, it's like a library. And when you select something, it will download the files for that and, you can play it. Yeah. And, it's not just Flash. There's like HTML5 and, like Adobe Air, stuff in there as well.
Yeah. It's a launcher, like launching a baby out of Elian Gonzalez. To see the trajectory and land on the right spot, like those games were. Mateus asks, so you guys are both Mega Man fans. I'm curious, did either of you take a dip into either of the GBA series, the Zero or Battle Network games? Zero has a little bit more of the lore, but it's miles better than X's in concept mostly, but also execution. It's more out there. And Battle Network has the best random battle engine I've ever experienced.
The Zero and ZX games are hideous to me. They're way too zoomed in and the characters are ugly and it is kind of borderline unreadable. It's bad sprite work to my mind, which has been a bit of a barrier. I tried revisiting them when that collection came out recently. And no dice. And it never had any interest in Battle Network.
I feel the same thing with Battle Network aesthetically.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk to Mega Man. Mm-hmm. I don't get it. I don't understand why Mega Man would be like that. You know, it's just I don't know. It's not somewhere I'm seeking story, and every time story has been provided to me from it, it's not been a story I've been very interested in. Like I really wish it was just more totemic, like more just there's Mega Man and there's X and there's Proto, and like just let it be this kind of pantomime where you get to the action. Mm-hmm. Every screenshot I've ever seen of Battle Network is teens standing around talking forever.
Yeah.
So I can't. Yeah. I can't. And then same thing with Zero. I don't think Zero looks very good for me. Yeah. So I'm sure they're fine if I had grown up with those aesthetics kind of, you know, in place.
Yeah.
I just hadn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do two more of these, do you think?
Sure.
Yeah, these are both related. So Sean says, hey guys, I wanted to recommend Chained Echoes for the next time you feel the need to scratch that JRPG itch. It fixes a lot of the issues Gary brought up in his blog post, as well as what was discussed on the podcast. For example, grinding is non-existent and no random battles. The game has its issues. I don't like the mech fights toward the end, but it is far and away the best JRPG that I have played in years and felt fresh. It really brought back my love for the genre that I haven't felt since early Pokemon games. I understand the instinct behind this, but it feels a little bit like trying to sell screen doors to somebody whose house just got broken into.
I'm speaking for you, Gary. I appreciate it. People are nice about this, and I appreciate the kindness that comes behind it. I think that what's happening is there's not an itch for me. Yeah. It's not the only reason why my issues with the genre are a problem to be solved. There's one because we do the show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's an expectation, as a major genre to cover them. And that's the reckoning I had this summer, was kind of trying to deal with that. And two, the fact that I used to like them. But it's only in the concept of this that it's a problem, you know? Whereas in real life, what anyone would do in my situation is just be like, oh man, I don't play games I don't like.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the same way that like you, Cole, don't play like professional football games. Like you don't play Madden.
Yeah.
You know, there's and Sean probably doesn't play Madden. You know, I don't there's a weird thing with these sometimes where it's like I don't know what the draw would be. You can eliminate a lot of problems, but what is going to get me into this? What you know, what does this have over something like I could play like a Disgaea or whatever. You know, I could play a tactics RPG and get a system I like better without any compromise. You know? It's just a weird thing. There's no itch. So I appreciate that, and I've heard this before. I've heard this is a good game. I believe it.
Yeah.
I 100% believe people. I believe that it probably solves a lot of those things and has done a lot of advancement for the genre. Good. You know, that's awesome. All I want is for fans of this genre to have better.
Yeah.
You know, to not have to deal with your Dragon Quest IVs.
Yeah.
And you know, and this is what's doing it. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, I just don't I'm good.
No. How magnanimous of you.
I'm magnanimous. I have friends who are into them, and I want them to have their thing. You know, I watched that trailer, the release trailer for Armored Core 6, and I can't make a thing out of any frame of it. I was like, this doesn't look like anything. Like it just particle effects and just brown, you know, like robots moving around. And I was like, but this is going to make somebody like super happy. Good for them.
Yeah.
You know, good for them. You gotta the real world where that's okay. It's not your thing. Yeah. You don't play baseball games. Why do you got to play this? you know. The secondary question is kind of similar to this, but with an older game. Eric talks about Shining Force 2.
Yes.
You know, resolving some of those things, which is cool because it's ahead of the time. I like this quote here in the question. Admittedly, the story is Baby Town Frolics, which is a great way to put a lot of this stuff. I think. I don't remember. I played Shining Force 1. I can't remember if I played Shining Force 2. If so, it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Do not recall.
Yeah. I mean, early console strategy RPG with a lot of the trappings of an older style console RPG is interesting and would be like a direction to possibly go in a putative future where we have the itch to cover more of these. That, and it's Sega. I know there is a there is a hunger for these games, you know, to be talked about and covered. Jala fucking loves them.
Yeah, Jala's a big Shining Force fan, I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think I would probably want to do, if we could, something more advanced with fewer Baby Town Frolics and probably more complicated, you know, combat. But moving to a tactics RPG model is great to me. You know, get rid of the grind or the tappa.
Yes.
Let's move on to life questions.
Steven writes, hey guys, question for Cole. Back in February, I asked what kind of cars you have owned. You mentioned that you have had a series of Kia Souls for the past few years. Every time I heard that, I wondered how it's been with the huge trend of stealing Hyundais and Kias. Have you been lucky, or did it happen to you too? Steven, you have just outed yourself as somebody who does not listen to abject suffering.
It's funny how sometimes it's absolutely unreasonable. You know, but sometimes I'll be like, you know, man, how do you not know this? We talked about it. And then I think about like when I listen to podcasts and I remember every like side note Robert Evans drops about his life, you know, so I this, it's cool to miss it. It's fine to miss things like this. I'll let you tell a story because it happened to you.
Yeah, no, when we were in Milwaukee at the end of March for the Midwest Gaming Classic, we went to run an errand and my car was not in the parking lot. Thought maybe it got towed, and then a sinking feeling in my stomach when I talked to the security guard and he said, I believe, and I quote, "Oh yeah, we had one get away yesterday."
Yeah.
Fortunately, I got it recovered, which is nice, but you know, having to deal with the insurance system is just a fucking atrocity, either for health or for auto. I do not know if I'm going to get another Kia, which sucks because like, I really like the Soul. It is inexpensive. It has lots of creature comforts in it, and it is, comfortable for me to sit in as somebody who has built like a door.
Yeah.
You know, with wide shoulders and such. So maybe I'll get a new one. I don't know. My lease is up in December, but yeah, I did get hit by them Kia boys.
Yeah. I would recommend not getting the same car that has the flaw.
They fixed them though, is the thing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was enough. They got spanked. In fact, they had fixed them by the time that like the trend had started. Mm. I had the last model year that had the exploit to
gotcha.
It. So yeah.
Gotcha. Maybe I would just be superstitious enough to be like, you know,
yeah,
you had your chance. Like this is, it's a big, you know, it's the worst. It's the second worst thing that can happen to a car. You know,
true.
Like, it's on the bottom of the lake with you in it, but like, I don't know, man. What does a car company guy do to ruin your trust? Like,
I don't know. It's it is so cheap. They are such cheap cars.
Yeah,
is the thing. I don't care about cars. I just want to like have one that is relatively reliable, except when somebody uses a USB. Cable to steal it and to drive it and then crash it. Yeah.
To hot wire it, to cold wire.
Yeah. And like, I don't know, leasing for another 3 years and then revisiting the EV question later on, you know, you know, after that is advanced is also tempting. I don't know. For a similar car, I would have to like go up like $10,000 in MSRP.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to pay that monthly price, even if it's on a lease. So
yeah, we're thinking about,
yep,
either way. Yeah, it is a complicated question, but yeah, there's a whole Abject Suffering about it, Stephen. Mm-hmm. Check it out. You should listen to Abject Suffering.
You should. It's episode 500, The Wand of Gamelon, recorded right after this all happens.
Yes, live.
Yep.
Of a sort. Gabriel has two things. Thing one, I started recently working at an IT support help desk and had about a month of terrible phone anxiety. One technique I tried to calm myself down and sound calm to the user was to emulate Cole's type of speech. It sort of accidentally happened. I was just thinking to sound warm and calm, but realized I was sort of mimicking Cole's tone and speech patterns. So Cole, in a way, you're like my little Mike Ehrman Trout in my head. Thank you for the IT help. I'll let you decide how you feel about that, Cole. Thing two.
I'll respond after you read
with that. Thing two. You guys often mention using your mega elixirs in games instead of hanging on to it and never using it. Do you apply this mentality to real life? For instance, I put money into a savings account and have goals with it. But when it comes time to use it, I get that no, don't use your mega elixir feeling. How fast and loose are you with your real life resources? When I do crack that seal and use my resources IRL, it is usually followed up with that Dark Souls feeling of what do I have to lose when failing to recover lost souls?
I'm a little bit reluctant to spend, you know, money, but also, like, you know, you gotta, I don't know, if your roof is bad, you gotta buy a new roof. That was my largest expense here recently, you know, last year or whatever. Like, yeah, it's a, you know, it's sometimes you gotta crack open the piggy bank. Yeah. That involves breaking it, and that sucks because I don't know. To me, saving money feels better than spending it, and also I have very modest tastes. So,
I will have poor kid. Like, you can't get rid of that feelings of buying things, but it manifests in microwaves. Like, it manifests in like, oh, I should buy generic Kleenex. You know, as a thing. In terms of actually like breaking open a piggy bank, usually I will feel good about it. And the way I think about it to myself is like, what else is that for? You know, an example, like I've been in this dentist corridor and I'm going to be in that for the rest of the summer. And they keep warning me about the cost of like sedation and these things that make it better. Mm-hmm. And the way that I've, you know, there is a little bit of sticker shock, but then there's also like, what else is money for other than to make me, you know, to alleviate terror. You know, like, I mean, obviously you could donate it to starving children. Don't be that person. Yeah. And I do, you know, I you know, try to do good works, but the, you know, like money is to make me happier and to help people who I love. What else could it possibly be for? I can't take it with me. I don't have kids. There's no, if I die and I have a lot of money in my savings account, what happens? Nothing good. You know, so nothing good at all.
Not even if you die, but like if you end up having to go to a nursing home, guess what happens?
Yeah.
Either the government takes all that or you have to spend it on a bunch of stupid shit to draw your assets down.
Yep.
To get down to where Medicare or Medicaid can cover you. Yep. Right. Like that indignity does not even happen after you die. Yes. It happens in the lead up to it. So like
no interest in that, you know, so like this, it's what money is for. Like when I end up in a situation, and this is a position of privilege and everything, I'm disclaiming this a lot because I'm talking about spending money on what is a creature comfort, you know, and, and I've drilled in enough that I feel like I shouldn't do that. I shouldn't talk about it, but I've decided privately I can do it, which is ludicrous, you know, but if I'm like, man, I just don't feel, I can't cook tonight. Mm-hmm. I feel fucking, I'm depressed and I feel amotivational and stuff like that. What if I ordered a food? What if I bought myself some time and relief?
Yeah.
You know, I don't mind it. Like, I also like saving money, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It was an early like mental block for me to get past to feel okay with running the air conditioning. Then I ultimately decided, well, you know what? Like, I have the money. Air conditioning is a modern miracle, literally one of the best things that's ever been invented that is also slowly killing our planet.
Yes.
But, you know, it does not make sense for me to sit and be miserable and sweat as somebody who is very averse to heat and sweat when I could, you know, pay what ultimately amounts to maybe like $40 more a month to run it.
You press a button to make it go away. You throw a little bit of cash at it and like it impacts every part of your life. Like it's the same thing. Like I recently struggle with finding a good pillow. Right. Mm-hmm. Went to, and I was like, this fucking sucks. And I had a woke up and I was like, you know what? I'm going to go buy a nice pillow. You know, my previous attempts at nice pillows have not worked. I'm going to go to a pillow store, get a real weirdo, a real gaunt mortician looking motherfucker to sit down and sell me on pillows and try them all. And then I end up spending what feels like a silly amount of money to me on a pillow, except that I use it every day and it matters, because if I'm not sleeping, I'm not comfortable, I'm not happy throughout the whole day. And how do you put a price tag on that? You know, it's getting over it is very similar to the Mega Elixir thing, where like, what are they for? And this is different if you have kids, and it's different if you have somewhere where that money needs to go. If money's very tight, I'm not, you know, chiding anybody. But I'm chiding. I do think that there's, if you just have a mental block around it, it's worth getting over that. You know?
So
if you can.
If it's practical. If you can.
If you can. You know? It's okay to treat yourself sometimes. And it's not, and
by
it's
paying
also
for dental procedures.
And getting a pillow that is comfortable. That's not treating yourself. It's just horrible upbringings and the world that tries to convince you that is a treat. It's not a treat. It's a basic comfort. You know, that you can afford yourself.
Yeah.
I'm so mad thinking about this kind of stuff. Not mad at Gabriel and not mad at myself for denying myself things, you know, for so long, and mad at the systems and people that brought me up to think, no. Like, you don't spend money on a pillow. That's stupid. You know, like, that's just a pillow, you idiot. You can go get a $10 pillow that'll make your neck hurt worse than you've ever experienced in your life every single morning. You know,
and you can buy three of those a year, every year, for the rest of your shortened life because your neck is in a knot, or you can, you know, sink 2 years worth of that process into getting a good one. Got shame. Fuck it. Just fucking shame.
Yeah. It's a, ludicrous.
Ludicrous, I say. Dylan writes, I recently came to the realization that part of my love for outdoors adventures, like mountains and rivers, comes straight from video games. This fact would likely shock my mother. Growing up and playing RPGs like RuneScape, Elder Scrolls, and Final Fantasy, I got so excited for the idea of exploring a new location and learning something new about the landscape, and I wanted to do that in real life. My question is, have you guys ever seen an interest emerge from playing games that led to a real-life vocation or change? I think avocation probably would be better there.
The like, podcast simulator hasn't come out yet. I got, after I, when I was playing Rock Band for a couple of years, I bought an electronic drum kit and kind of taught myself how to play drums from it. Cause it's very similar. You know?
I mean, Guitar Hero and playing guitar, and I've always liked hanging out and fucking around in the woods. So I don't know that that can be games, but that's a nice little feedback loop.
Those are probably the closest for me, at least. I did read a book about arson after playing L.A. Noire.
Oh, cool.
But I didn't get into the evocation of it.
According to my attorney, I didn't do that.
Live up in the hills where there's lots of fires. My house is always safe, and I reckon that's sus. Media questions. Chase says, hey guys, this will probably be a stranger question, so bear with me. Basically, there's a rapper named Lil Uzi Vert. About 3 years ago, he released an album that featured heavy alien and abduction imagery theming audio. For whatever reason, that album has a hotline straight to the part of my brain that remembers Mothership Zeta. So now whenever I think of one, I automatically think of the other. My question is, do you guys have any weird mental connections like this where you can't think of one thing without thinking of another? Yes, we answered this a long time ago. This has been, because I remember talking about listening to R.E.M. Green on repeat while playing Arrow the Acrobat, and how those are connected in my mind now.
The music that I listened to, let's say between like the year 2000 and the year 2002, like anything that was in heavy rotation, you know, Foo Fighters, Eels, Queens of the Stone Age, you know, stuff that I still really enjoy, but like very specifically, like those albums that were out around then, Soul Jacker, There's Nothing Left to Lose, stuff like that. Any of those come up and immediately I'm playing EverQuest again. In my mind, I'm playing EverQuest and like, you know, like issuing Winamp commands through the chat through a little mod that I installed, you know, to make that happen. That is a neural pathway that is etched in stone.
Right on.
Can't hear Learn to Fly without thinking of running around in the Eastern Common Lands.
I think this is very common, you know, and the, it's nice.
Sorry okay. that this album that you apparently like reminds you of the worst Fallout DLC.
That is fucking sad to me. Little Uzi Vert.
Hmm.
Yeah. I love not knowing about rap. I'm interested in rap to a degree, but just not having very much of a, you know, there's hip hop I like and rap I like, but not knowing about it just means every once in a while I just get to hear fun little combinations of phrases like that.
Extremely good names. Yeah.
Lil Uzi Vert.
Yeah.
It's kind of a trick. It's kind of a small gun.
But the...
it's a skate style. It's all kinds of things.
But then you run into weird stuff like I cannot decode. God, this is just me just saying like, rap and anything but rap and country or whatever. But like, apparently at some point, people's rap names ended up being kind of like like clan tags from Team Fortress or Counter-Strike.
So where like they have
like they have like the prefix so like ASAP or whatever. Yeah, it's like okay, cool. I don't understand it, but I, you know, don't have a problem with it. So rock on.
Said, you know, on every episode of every show, basically, I love being old and I love having things not be my business. Yeah. Apparently Taylor Swift is causing earthquakes and shit. And I don't know. I don't, you know, she wants to complete the Magnus device on her own time. It's none of my business. Like,
I realized something. I know that I've heard a Taylor Swift song because I live in the world.
Yeah.
As much as I try not to, but I have not like willing like not heard one and thought, oh, that is Taylor Swift, or like could not hum a single bar of any of them. Which is not me saying I am too cool for it. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. It's just I'm very calcified in the kind of music that I listen to. So
it's not even, it's a cool thing. I think about that too, but then I also think it's more just it's similar to the console RPG thing, you know. It's just like I don't know, like you don't have to be into every single thing that exists. You know, it is not a responsibility to like everything.
Nope.
You know, it's a weird outlook that I think is not in, that is like pretty in style right now. Just the idea that you should just be versed with basically everything. And I don't have the time or interest in that personally.
Yeah. So that's, you know, and my disinterest is not a, you know, an implied disdain for people who are into it. Like, no,
it's just, I liked other stuff instead.
Yeah, listen to your Tookie stuff about messy breakups and empowerment. Like, rock on. Yeah. Cool.
Awesome. The Taylor Swift songs I've heard, I've liked. But I not enough to, like, it. I like it on, like, a pop curve. Like, I'm not a big, you know, modern radio pop guy.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, this is good. And then I go and listen to music that I like more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have a show question here from Will, who says, any chance of covering Dragon Quest III, even though Gary's fatigue with the genre has reached its peak? It's one of my all-time favorites, and while it has simple stories and scenarios, it bucks the series' reputation for goofiness and has a really appealing solemnity and sincerity to it. Probably not.
Yeah, sorry. I do not want to take your like away from that, but I wouldn't have fun, and I don't think you'd have fun. Nope. I don't have anything else to learn from that genre. Nope. I'm sorry.
That expression, especially that era for that genre, you know?
Yeah. Like there may be things later and stuff. But I don't know. Recounting that plot doesn't sound interesting to me.
Yeah.
I might read about it. Like it's interesting that it has a different tone and everything like that, but I don't want to play it.
Nope.
Moving on to lightning round. Harrison says, can you speak on the issue of gamer American rights? What are some major ideas or demands in the history of this movement, and where might such attitudes have come from? Do you think these demands have informed game development? Love the term and the show. Thank you.
I think the most important principle, the foundational pillar of gamer American rights, is the notion that anybody who has a platform, either by making games or by talking about them, if they slip up in any small way and I point it out, I should immediately be able to take their place and inherit all of their esteem and their resources.
That is a, that is the gold standard, not the gold standard of rules, but very similar to switching to the gold standard. Is what I'd refer to that as. That is a flat tax proposal we can all believe in terms of gamer American rights.
It's the Highlander principle.
Yeah.
You know, there can be only one.
Yeah. That's a good one. And I wish it success in the gamer Senate. the three wings of gamer government. Major Mike. What does Colin say?
Colin says, I'd like to recommend Dredge, a Lovecraftian horror fishing game with some RPG elements on Steam. Just finished it and had a great time for a great price. I feel like this would be great for a Halloween episode or a Lovecraft special. Stick around to the end of the show,
funny
bud.
Funny you should say that.
Funny you should say that now in this episode.
John says, how good would you say you both are at video games on a scale of 0 to 100, with 100 being Lobos beating Sekiro with a ladle using a Guitar Hero controller? Sorry if this is a repeat question.
I don't know. I'd put myself at about 50. People have watched me stream, so they can have a pretty good feeling about it. This also is really genre dependent too. So just going to put myself in the middle.
Yeah. It's super genre dependent. There are things I'm like a 90 at, and there are things I'm like a 10 at.
Yeah.
You know, so it's probably a 50 on average, but it's swings wildly. There's very few things I'm just fine at. I guess like MassoCore platformers, I think I'm fine at. Like I can usually get to the end of them. I don't love them that much, but I put myself at fine.
Yeah, fine.
Yeah, it really depends on the genre though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's hear. Naveen says, Exhibit has pimped out your ride. Not pimped out, pimps your ride. That's a very different thing.
Exhibit.
Exhibit.
Come on, man. Ride
has from the television show Pimped Your Ride.
Yes.
In addition to the hydraulic sick paint job and custom rims, he has also put in an AV system with screens. He is about to put in game consoles so you can have a game while you drive because he heard you like gaming. What a ridiculous show.
There's a YouTube I found I haven't watched it yet. YouTube just keeps trying to recommend it to me, where it's a guy who buys old Pimp My Ride cars and talks about what travesties they are in terms of cars. Buys old ones. They're just like, they did not know what they were doing. This makes no sense. And just kind of like deconstructs the concept of the show,
you know,
15 years later through buying cheap cars that people got rid of.
But to finish this out, but he asks you which game system, past or present, you would prefer go in the car. What console are you going with?
My instinct is to say something you can play while driving, which are very few consoles.
You
can maybe do like an R Zone overlay or something like that over one eye and play that while driving with your other eye or something. But as somebody who doesn't drive, I could do almost anything as a passenger, in the car, like Liv's car could become thus pimped and I would just.
Anything? I mean, motion sickness, dog.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could do a lot of stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
That's true, too. Motion sickness would be a problem. And I would want something you can play in very short amounts, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe like iOS.
You want a little Fruit Ninja?
Yeah, maybe something like
that. Module in the back?
Yeah, because it's like, it's always, you know, I have tons of software on it. They're all short. They probably won't give me motion sickness because there's very little 3D movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Know. I'm just going to say SNES with a multi-tap so we can play Bomberman.
Yeah. Bomber.
That seems like a Bomberman. Fun thing to play. Yeah. Well, you know, just if I'm thinking of four people in a car.
Yeah. Driver loses each time.
Gosh.
Tom says, how do you feel about the haunted spaceship trope, i.e. Dead Space, Event Horizon, Alien, etc. in horror fiction? Any favorite or least favorite examples?
There is a very good alien-like Twine game called Terror Aboard the Speedwell that is actually really good. I would recommend playing that. Generally, though, like, I don't know, Dead Space didn't really blow my hair back too much. Alien is, it feels sui generis and also does not feel like it does not feel like it being in space, like... is a you could do that in a submarine. You do that in a submarine, right?
It's I feel similar. The spaceship is too anonymous, you know, like my favorite version of this is probably System Shock 2. Just because it is a living space, or Prey,
and
like, you know,
Prey is a good
people
one.
Live there. I don't care for industrial hallways full of pipes, basically ever. So it's, I love Alien, I love the movie Alien. Don't get me wrong, but it's not a genre that drives me.
Mm-hmm.
So personally.
Event Horizon can be fun.
Yeah, no, there's
Sam Neill. Yeah,
yeah, and like, you know, Dead Space isn't a bad game. I love Alien. Like these things are all fine. You know, they're just not my favorite thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Michelle asks, so the latest episode of Quackstack served as a nice reminder that every day on my commute to work, I pass by the public restroom where Forrest McNeil reviews the concept of glory holes.
Yay! The maven of the stall.
If you can do it without doxing yourself, what's the funniest local landmark that you have lived near?
I can walk over to the hardware store where what is his name? Not Danger Aaron, where one of the Jackass guys took a shit in the toilet that wasn't hooked up to anything in the hardware store. I can walk over to that. Cool. I mean, it's a long walk, so it's not really doxing myself. Yeah. But you know, I can take a long walk to that if I want to.
Mm-hmm. Do they have a plaque up?
I've actually never done it. It's a hardware store. Yeah. I don't have any hardware needs. I'm not that kind of lifestyle. Oh, so
you have hardware needs.
I don't have hardware needs. It's amazing. Oh. It's crazy how there's just a flip that either is on or off. You either have tons of hardware needs and you're constantly going to a hardware store, or you're never going to a hardware store.
I think you're in denial about your hardware store needs.
What would a hardware store do for me other than let me look at a famous turd? I don't know what I'd get at a hardware store.
Where are you going to get your hammers?
Don't need it. Got a hammer.
Okay.
Bought it from Internet. Is it about once a year?
Okay. And just what you got there? You got a claw hammer?
It has a claw on the back.
Okay. What about what if you need to something in a mallet?
I don't. Won't need a mallet.
Okay.
What do I do with a mallet?
I don't know. Might come up.
They're not going to come up. I suppose I could probably try to kill like a varmint with it or something. But I could do that with a hammer. You know,
okay.
Anyway, the all hammer right. basically does all my hammering for me.
Pretty confident there.
Okay. Yeah, I could kill a farm with a hammer. It's a tiny little baby hammer too. It's just for hanging up paintings and stuff, pictures. It's not a good hammer, but I don't need. I do other stuff.
Okay.
No. Do you live by any famous landmarks?
I mean, the usual one. I talk about the OSR, the state prison. When I lived in Cincinnati, it's very funny because there the park that was nearest to my college house, south of the University of Cincinnati campus, has like these weird pavilions or whatever. It was the site of it was the filming site for a Three Doors Down music video. Yeah, and it's the band playing up on these weird concrete awnings, and then Johnny Kryptonite or whatever the main guy's name is, Johnny votes for Trump, like running around like the Over the Rhine neighborhood or whatever, either toward or from something.
Okay.
Yeah. But specifically that park, it's a Three Doors Down video location. So
yeah, finally. Three Doors Down getting their due.
Why Cincinnati? I have no idea. They are not connected to the area at all.
No. Yeah. KL asks, what's something both of you like for wildly different reasons? As an example, I like the Castlevania games for their hammer horror aesthetics and gameplay, while my friend likes the series for the plot because they are a fucking space alien. Yeah, they are. I'm playing Aria of Sorrow right now and like finding out that there are people who go to bat for the plots of these games and losing my mind. I love being interrupted by a random anonymous Bishonen basically between every level. In just a hallway that from now on will be an annoying thing I have to walk through.
Mm-hmm.
Like they couldn't put anything in the hallway, but they know you have to backtrack through it. So they just had the guy come and be like, have you unleashed your dark power? Perhaps you will. Mm. And then just leave. Like, what the fuck was that about, man?
You will not Dracula's. Be Dracula. I will be Dracula. Yeah,
who Dracula's go round and around in Aria of Sorrow. Just give me fucking things to punch. I don't know. I want Contra level shit for that. So your friend, even though they're not a lonely space alien, they're several of their species.
Yes. I don't know. Can you think of an example of this? I feel like we're pretty aligned. Like there's nothing that I can think of that is mutually exclusive.
No, I think you and I will come down, just with degrees, but not different things as much. Well, here's one. I think that you and I probably appreciate Resident Evil lore in a different way.
Yeah, that's probably right.
That's probably the closest one. And I'm not, there's no judgment, you know, in that at all. I'm not calling you a fucking space alien. It's just, you know, I like a more zoomed out approach to that plot and big picture stuff. The nitty gritty will fuck with me, you know, Blue Umbrella and everything. I can't follow that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas I think that you have an appreciation for it.
Yeah. If I see the hair on the back of my neck stands up when I see the progenitor virus mentioned somewhere.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that guy. Yeah.
It lives in a flower. Yes.
Yeah. That's probably the closest thing I can think of. But even that's still not a perfect, or it's more Venn than not.
Yeah. Let's go with that example.
Yeah.
Abe says, did Cole ever get around to recreating the whale's shamrock logo? I re-listened to the Sonic 2 episode of Adaptation Decay for the fourth time just to hear Gary and Will's dumbfounded silence at Cole's revelation.
Is a good, is a great deployment, even though it is on our highest tier thing. So it's keeping people away from that. Very, very important.
Is it keeping people? Is it keeping people away from it or drawing them towards it?
I hate listeners. That's up to you. You can join the Adaptation Decay tier for $10 a month. You can just do it once, listen to all the back episodes. Mm-hmm. And it does have a moment where Cole talks about his high school
friend group.
It's not really a thing. It's a concern that he called the whales shamrock.
No, I didn't call it. I sidled into it sideways. Yeah.
A thing called the whale shamrock. Those two things have to do with each other, you'll never know.
Yep. Unless you listen. Yeah. No, I never recreated the logo. I like it being a mystery because whenever it comes up, I like seeing people guessing at what it was.
I did a lot of image searches for Irish whales. You can find a lot of them. Ryan says, would Wolf in White Van by John Darnielle work for Adaptation Decay?
Fuck yeah, it would.
Sure. Yeah. I've been meaning to give that a reread at some point. It's it's difficult from a preparation to output standpoint in terms of note taking and recording and reading.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, like where Adaptation Decay to like put it into, you know, terms, we'll watch a movie or like this month we're watching two cartoons, you know. Yes. Very different than reading a full novel in terms of time. That's the only thing holding us back.
Yeah. So. But we've talked about it before.
Yes.
Yeah. I love that book. I love that story. It is wonderfully bleak. Yeah.
Yeah. The, yeah. And what is our final question?
Final question is Jared saying, 2E, this must be a typo or something, but saying, I'm wishing that the Everything to Guppy pivot is Gary and Will doing commentaries on the WAF skits, Everything to WAF tracks.
Never.
That would be really mean because I would not be present, and a good number of those, roughly half, are, you know, my concept and my writing.
Well, and not only that, but like also some of those I like, but it's not work. You know, we stopped doing that for a reason. Part of the reason why we stopped doing it was having to phone it in from time to time, having to phone it in from time to time and opening that up to the vulnerable. Like this question betrays a deep misunderstanding of Will. at the end of the day,
one of the more enigmatic figures on the network.
Yes. I love Will very much. He is a good person. I'm not comfortable being that vulnerable with him. It would bring up too many things that are genuine philosophical differences between he and I in how think humor and writing is constructed. That it would get into reels too quick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That would almost need to be something Will did on his own and me and Cole never heard it.
Yes.
But I also don't want that.
No, I'd rather not.
Yeah. Moving on to our topic for this episode, I'll read here. It's Troy's, and we're kind of using this as a jumping off point for a more general thing. Troy says, I think Ghost of Tsushima's gameplay is solid. Fighting enemies is a ton of fun, and the upgrade system is fun to explore. I don't mind running errands and traveling around the open world to earn business or learn bonuses, loot, and experience, especially with the fast travel option. What I do mind are cutscenes that you can't skip. Dear Lord, the game makes you watch these 5 minute or longer scenes that completely ruin the flow of gameplay. I can only handle about 15 to 20 hours worth and called it quits because I felt like the game was wasting my time. I am baffled that this game was so well received by some folks. It's like playing in quicksand. So my question is, what other games have you played that won't let you skip cutscenes that would have been awesome otherwise? On the other side of the coin, what great games do you think could benefit from adding cutscenes or building a more robust story? We're kind of using this as a jumping off point to talk about cutscenes in general, not specifically skippable or unskippable cutscenes.
Yes.
Even though that's obviously a watchword for the combo.
Oh, certainly, yeah. That's fucking baffling that a game that came out in 2020 would not let you skip cutscenes.
It's, it is fascinating that they did that and they didn't patch it out. Like, nobody complained about it and then they didn't fix it. I have a weird thing. So when people talk about skipping cutscenes, and this is on me, I'm not saying this as a criticism. I have a hard time skipping cutscenes. I can resent a cutscene, but the fact that you can skip it usually doesn't help me very much because I'm too afraid I will miss something important, that something later that might be cool will rely on. Mm-hmm. And my judge it if it's on the plate feelings of playing a video game. And that's not just for work. Like when I play a game, if the games ask me to pay attention to something, like I want to pay attention to it, see what they're going for with it. So for me, it's like two separate problems. Like it is obvious that you should be able to skip cutscenes. Mm-hmm. There's not an argument for not being able to do it that I can think of. At the same time, I also want, like, so there's two issues. There's like skippableness and then like artfully deploying and, you know, deploying with pacing. Is that the best way to tell your story? Is that the only way to like increase narrative density in a story? What are you gaining with that mode versus another way of storytelling?
And obviously the pitfall that you can fall into is expressed extremely with the creator. Hideo Kojima, or run into David Cage. Obviously we have this Saw, and we get it out quite frequently, which is like, if you want to make a movie, make a movie, kind of deal. And I say that as somebody who enjoys his work, right? Or at least can find things to enjoy, to enjoy in it. So like when you deploy this mode of storytelling, just like you start edging into a different, trying to ape a different medium. See also like Last of Us, right?
Yes. And with something like The Last of Us, there are more comfortable and less comfortable fits for this kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like The Last of Us, the fact that that is so cinematic from the jump makes that fit work a little bit better for me. The cutscenes are well made and well acted. It's a little bit immaterial to the idea that the game is largely about telling a story, like a cinematic story. That's the whole thing for the game. What will happen with, what it sounds like with Ghost of Tsushima, which I've not played, but also happens with Metal Gear games with me, is that that's not what the game is. The game is a thing you play and experience ludically. It's not setting out to be a movie. It just has wedges of movie crammed into it, and that is a much more awkward fit to me. I don't want to let like something like The Last of Us off the hook that much, though, because that's a real exception, at least for my taste. Like, I would prefer there be a lot fewer cutscenes in games in general. I don't think it is a very interesting way to tell a story just by sitting down and watching it while you're playing a game. I don't like what they do to pacing. I think it's a really different skill set, creating a cutscene than game design, in a general sense. Like it's engaging with something very different. It's hard for me to respect as a thing.
Yeah. And just like, what is the information being conveyed? Right. Because like, if it's just dialogue, all right, well, like that probably could happen while I'm doing stuff, right? Yep. And not just in a, we are hiding a loading screen by making you move, slowly and having you talk on a walkie-talkie, doing like the Gears of War thing, right? If it's dialogue or characterization, there are probably other and better ways to do that that make use of the medium. And if it's action, why is that not being expressed as play?
Yeah.
Why am I looking at somebody do something cool when I could do something cool?
Exactly. Like the, there's a thing, there's a dissonance that happens in games that has never ceased to bother me, which is, you know, a character in a cutscene doing a billion backflips. And then when you actually play the game, they just stand there and wait and then like swing their sword once.
Yeah.
You know, like that idea that that's frustrating to me. I understand the idea is you're supposed to be rounding up the them staying there and swinging their sword once in your imagination to them doing the backflips. It has the opposite effect for me.
It's so hard not to see the contrast, you know, and feel it viscerally. Yeah.
It rounds down the cutscenes into feeling like nothing. Like, hey, you know, it's the Metalloid Maniac. Like, let's learn more about this in a cartoon. You know, like, it has nothing to do with what I'm doing. I don't embody the character anymore. You know, I don't feel continuity with it.
Metalloid Maniac is such a good touch point for this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, just out of nowhere, like, hey, what if, let's learn more about the lore through a cartoon. Yeah.
You know, and you know, just and really, really heighten the contrast between, you know,
what
like,
it oh, actually it's, is.
Is this his ground? And, you know, did, you know, it like, and also like the actual reality, which is it's an old man fighting against gravity and very slowly moving around and everybody trying to pretend like it is not the worst thing in the world to watch.
Yep. And, you know, you can have the Metalloid Maniac crawling on the wall being the same thing as like Cloud swinging a sword versus Cloud doing a backflip in a cutscene, you know, as a thing. Like, it is a real rough thing for me for continuity. Like I don't feel embodied by my character. Like, embodiment in a character is a weird kind of thing that I've been thinking about recently. Like, that feeling of like, am I, you know, do I feel any of this? Like, even, and it always ruins that even when I've accomplished it.
Yeah.
It's a thing too, where I think just keeping your powder dry on it. Like, if you, there's probably is some information that can only be portrayed through cutscenes, like certain kinds of scale, you know, but you, it's the overuse that really bothers me. So like a good one, you know, a famous good cutscene, I think like you land in Anor Londo and you get 3 seconds of like sweeping vista just to show you how big the place is. And then it stops. You're done. Like, I know how big it is. Let's check it out. I don't know.
Boss intros for characterization. I think that is especially good, especially if it gives you like a really good look at the arena for a particular detail that's there. See the dragon above the Duke's beloved Freya. See the old monk's room. I'm going to soul stuff because
they're really good at it.
It's incredibly good.
And and the cutscenes in the beginning are never just like characters you know from the game talking. They're setting up a philosophy and a mood for the whole thing. You get, you know, a cutscene in the beginning, you get little intro cutscenes for some enemies and areas, and you get an ending one. It's never just going to stop and explain plot to you, which is just, again, failure of the medium, failure of imagination. I think
protracted dialogue segments where you are making choices, a la in a Mass Effect, you know, or other BioWare RPG, or, you know, going into like a Larian or an Alpha Protocol, you know, kind of deal where you are watching people talk, but you are guiding it, even if it is just selecting what information you want to learn in which order. Do you consider that to be a cutscene?
It's just a dialogue thing. Okay. That's a dialogue choice. Yeah. Like, it's doing something with the camera. It's doing something, adding visual flourish while you're making gameplay choices, you know, and talking. Like, I'm not against dialogue. Dialogue in games for storytelling. I think of that as different. One of the bigger things that that ties with this that I consider to be like pretty frustrating is a cutscene as a substitution for gameplay in a literal sense. I'm thinking about the ending, the climaxes of the boss battles in Final Fantasy 16, which I've not played myself yet. I've just read about and watched. So somebody can, you know, I could be fake gamer for this, but my understanding is you get to the end and then you watch a cutscene of your summon fighting, you know, instead of you finishing off the enemy, you just watch a movie. Let's watch this cartoon. And the idea is that's going for spectacle, right? I don't find most video games to be as deft as spectacle as even pretty average movies. And part of it is that I'm just not in that mode. Like, I'm not looking for that, you know? And so it doesn't really matter if it would be a fine CG cutscene in an action movie. Like, I'm not playing an action movie. I'm watching a movie. You know, I want to do the cool thing. Let me do the fucking cool thing. You know,
this gets really basic, but I feel like it's worth saying as well. I never like being interrupted. And oftentimes, you know, the worst examples, you look back to when we talked about Final Fantasy 12, right?
Yes.
A game that I enjoy and enjoy much more than you. But I think, anybody would be dishonest to ignore the fact that a lot of that, too much of it, if not a lot, is you watch a cutscene, then you walk down a hallway and there's another cutscene there.
Yes.
This was also the case in Final Fantasy X, right? It's kind of a hallmark of an era,
yes,
you know, to a degree. And it's also a problem in Final Fantasy 16 from what I have played.
Yeah.
Right. I don't like being interrupted. There is some joy to be found in some of the codec conversations in a Metal Gear game to me, performances and what have you. But I don't know, and then you go through the big long thing and then you walk and you open the next door and then
time for timeout.
Time for timeout. It feels like getting a phone call at an opportune time. I don't care for it. I don't like being interrupted at all.
I don't like it. And it's also a thing where it's going to make it sound like we are anti-narrative in a thing. And I want to, draw the point back again to what the game's trying to do. If I feel being interrupted more harshly when I'm eager to actually do a thing, I don't feel interrupted by a cutscene when I'm playing the quarry, because that's what I'm there for.
Or Life is Strange.
I do feel interrupted by a cutscene in Metal Gear because it is trying to have its cake and eat it too. The other thing with both of those examples, with Final Fantasy 12, Final Fantasy 10, and Metal Gear, I haven't played Final Fantasy 16 with this yet, is just discernment in choosing content and pacing of these cutscenes. One of the things that's frustrating about Final Fantasy 12's cutscenes, which again, to clarify, I do like that game, right? I like Final Fantasy 12, is that the cutscenes all have a cinematic setup and warm up and cool down to them. So not only do you have questionable kind of content a lot of the time that could have been expressed a different way, it's happening too frequently. And then the camera has to kind of poetically swing down for a little bit to frame everything, or it has to do a slow pan up from the worm's eye view to show something. And these things are arguably artful, that there's art happening in them, but it contributes to that ruining of pace. The idea that we have to stop, wind up, and then wind down in addition to being interrupted. It's like you're getting an alarm telling you you're about to get a phone call, then you get a phone call, and then you get an alarm that says the phone call went away. in terms of things there are ways to do that and make that better. I refuse to believe that fucking Square Enix has perfected this art. Or that Hideo Kojima has. There has to be a way to do that. And just if you need to have the cutscene, compact the information, be a little bit more judicious with having it. Some of that stuff maybe is something you get another way. Characters talk about it, you get through a log, you get through a codex, any number of things.
I
don't know.
And it falls under the general banner of edit your shit.
Yes. Edit your shit and be very mindful when you are taking control away from a player.
Yeah.
It is a tricky thing to do. One of the big game debates is whether the Half-Life method is good. We had a question about that a long time ago about in Half-Life 2, they never take player control away from the player, but then you end up jumping on boxes in the corner during a conversation. You can have a preference between one of those two things, but at the same time, the main thing with Half-Life 2 is it has three cutscenes.
Yeah.
It's also keeping its powder dry with its storytelling. It's not constantly yanking you out. Reason why we all remember jumping in the corner while Dr. Kleiner explained his pet, head grab is that it's one of just a couple things that happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I never want more, in the second part of the question, I'm never I wish this had cutscenes.
Yeah.
Just
maybe at a time, you know, maybe I would have, you know, like back in like the PS1 era, mm-hmm. PS2, I had a little bit more of an appetite for it. It just kind of ceases to be special.
Yeah.
After a certain amount of time, you know, after you've seen enough of it.
And now that I have spent more time with alternative ways of telling stories, like having, you know, audio logs play while I'm exploring, having characters mm-hmm. talk while walking away has been a revelation.
Yeah.
You know, that just, it feels more natural.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, boo. Boo to them. I borrowed Pokemon Arceus from Brayden because I have a little bit of a Pokemon itch, even though it has mm-hmm. you know, turn-based battles. And the main thing that has stopped me from like diving in is everyone being like, yeah, there's 2 hours of like fucking bullshit isekai cutscene in the beginning of it. And I'm like, well, you know what? Like, why? Mm-hmm. That is literally maybe going to make me not play this game that I'm borrowing for free.
Yeah.
Why you got to fucking do that? I don't know.
Because that's what, you know. That's games to people.
Somebody must like it, you know. Somebody must fucking love it. and I don't understand.
Not at all.
You know, not for me. So,
nope.
Let us move on to our responses.
Mm-hmm. Let's do. Going over here. So we don't have any responses about Lisa. Mm-hmm. because of the switchover that we did relatively late in the month. If you write in about Lisa, we'll throw a few of those on next dispatch.
Yes.
Depending on how things go. So ended up letting a few more through for Mystical Ninja and Dragon Quest IV as a result, if it feels like more of these got through.
Yes.
starting off here with Kian, who says, hey guys, did you manage to get through the entire game without seeing the bonkers death screen? Because I feel like you would have mentioned it. hey, Gary, did you watch this?
I did watch it on this YouTube. I did get through the game without seeing a death screen because it's
not a very easy game.
It's super easy, and I was playing on an emulator. Uh-huh. You know, so if I was one hit away from death, I was like, basically, that is fine. It is two demons hula hooping.
Two very buff demons.
Yes.
Who are not clothed very much, hula hooping as they rotate around a disco ball.
Yes. I think they're the same demons from the fortune teller guy. I think they're hanging out in that room, maybe.
The plasma guy. Possibly. Okay. It shares a very similar aesthetic. What's the significance? I don't know.
Yeah. Not sure.
No.
Christian says, I was the patron who executive produced the Mystical Ninja show, and I loved it. Really appreciate you doing justice to this quintessential 7 out of 10 game. My affection for it likely stems from having bonded with people through Mystical Ninja 64, both as a kid playing it with a buddy via Blockbuster rental in the 90s, and as an adult who began a close friendship with somebody by initially discussing our mutual love of Mystical Ninja. That person even later got me hooked on WoF. Aw. As Cole said, the appeal of something being openly Japanese during an era when localization tended to scrub those details off was likely a factor as well. When replaying recently, I enjoyed its lush visual design and weirdly spacious locations, but found the gameplay desperately in need of a lock-on button. All that said, I really appreciate the coverage. Thanks again for Watch Out for Fireballs number 405.
Oh, well, thank you for your support, and I am very happy that you enjoyed the episode.
Yeah, very happy.
Yeah.
I think it's a good one. We've been on a nice streak.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Oh. And this makes sense. I, you know, because of when the N64 came out of my life, it's very much associated with school and playground stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of thing. I have no idea what Christian's age is, but yeah, like this would have been a, you know, just a game that would have come up when, you know, just hanging around, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, makes total sense.
Yeah. Chris writes, I just wanted to thank you for playing this game and giving it a chance. I've always felt like it was somewhat underrated. I played this game as a kid on the N64, and it became one of my favorites. I was thoroughly enchanted by almost everything about it, and to this day, I still listen to the soundtrack. I remember enjoying the sound design and voice acting so much that I would continuously swap characters while playing just to hear their lines. Even if the gameplay didn't change much, and I didn't know Japanese. In fact, I replayed this game so much as a kid that to this day, I can walk through a lot of it in my head. It was difficult for me to hear criticisms of it because I obviously haven't a lot of nostalgia for it, but I also found it hard to disagree with you on anything that you said. I think this game had a reasonable difficulty level and appropriate amount of content for gamers who were my age at that time, but I fully acknowledge my nostalgia factor here. At any rate, thanks again for giving one of my favorite games some airtime, and also for your analysis. I'm really glad you didn't hate it.
Yeah, didn't hate it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a thing. There are things that I think live best in nostalgia for that. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. A lot of games where it's like, you know what, there was a time and a place for this. Mm-hmm. You earlier were talking about Arrow the Acrobat. Played a lot of that as a kid. Probably don't need to revisit that.
No.
You know, I'm probably good. Let that be a warm memory. You know?
Yeah.
Like listening to Orange Crush and crushing it with my little man.
Yeah. And, you know, the nostalgia is not a bad thing. I get more comfortable indulging in it every day.
Yeah.
It is valuable, but it is also worth understanding, you know, how it might be affecting your analysis and evaluation of a work.
Yeah. Well, and even this isn't even, you know, going back to something, leaving it to nostalgia isn't shattering nostalgia against it. You know, sometimes it's leaving it holy and leaving it contained. I don't want to risk the nostalgia. So I'm going to leave that as it is. Mm-hmm. You know, that's always been, again, I talk about Will a lot for Games Opinions because I talk to Will about games. And that is Will's approach to a lot of this stuff. And I respect it. Like, it's a good approach. You know, I'm not going to replay that because I don't know if it'll hold up. I'd rather just have the memories of it.
Yeah. You know? Seems like a pretty good way to honor your, you know, happiness or contentment with media.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lexi says, hi. I don't know how else to deliver this information, but I just want to let Cole know, I'm sure I'm late, but still, that Mystical Ninja on the SNES was actually the first Goemon SNES game, even in Japan. And there were, in fact, three more released in Japan before the Nintendo 64 one, guys, the one that you guys covered on the show. You can find really high-quality fan localizations of all four SNES Goemon games on romhacking.net. They are increasingly bizarre, and in the third, I think, Impact is introduced and the mechanics are nearly identical to the N64 game. They're all great. Take care.
Oh, good to know. Yeah. I didn't know there were that many. I didn't know the one we got was the first, and I didn't know that all of them have been fan localized.
Yeah. It's interesting to know that Impact came from something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't just like, hey, everybody remember Impact?
Yeah. No.
Why does he look like Goemon? We don't know. Thank you for the heads up. Steven writes, when you said on the show that you were going to cover Mystical Ninja 64, you unlocked a load of childhood memories for me. I would have been 9 years old in 1997 when this came out, and that was such a glorious era of gaming to grow up in. Metal Gear Solid, Ocarina of Time, Final Fantasy VII. I feel sorry for kids today whose core gaming nostalgia memories will largely be games as a service products like Fortnite or annual recycled Call of Duty / sports games. Mystical Ninja was absolutely the most batshit crazy thing I'd ever seen in my life, and it flooded my tiny brain with more dopamine than it could handle. I still vividly remember the weird songs, and at the time, I thought that the transition to the giant mech battles were some of the most epic sequences in gaming. In hindsight, the N64 didn't have great specs, but for context, I went from Sega Mega Drive to N64, so the upgrade in generation was such a massive leap. I have fond memories of the gameplay and plot, and look forward to your take on it. I'm in two minds about whether or not to replay. Mostly, when I replay something that has great nostalgia, I find the experience to be quite hollow once that initial rush wears off and you realize the mechanics or whatever don't hold up to modern standards. I assure you, we were not keeping Steven's response in mind.
As an answer to that thing.
Yeah.
I don't read these in advance. Good instincts, I think. A great way to indulge that, what I've been doing, is finding, and there are a few of them that I want, but going to LP Archive and sorting by screenshot Let's Play. I'm not really interested in watching a Let's Play that's video, but I love screenshot Let's Plays. And there are a bunch of older games that I liked, that I'm like, hey man, this is a version of that dopamine feeling.
Yeah.
But I just read it before bed.
Yeah. And there's always listening to the soundtrack too.
Yeah. Yeah, looking at the screen, even like reading a game fact about it. There's lots. I love the meta engagement with that kind of stuff rather than actually direct engaging with it.
Yeah.
You know, keeps nostalgia alive. I don't need to play EVO again, but I love that screenshot LP.
Yeah.
Gordon says, I was one of the three people total who played Mystical Ninja 64, having bought it as I had somehow convinced myself that it was going to be like a slightly lower quality Ocarina of Time. I have absolutely no memories of playing it, though. When I think back, all I get is a kaleidoscope of colors, madness, and stiff animations. Who was I fighting, and why? No idea. The only exception is the giant robot song, which comes through crisp and clear as I managed to somehow learn all of the Japanese lyrics as permanently embedded in my memory. The sole survivor of my mind from however long I spent with this game. Really looking forward to the episode so I can finally learn what the hell happened during that missing time. Hopefully Cole took rigorous notes to avoid game memory wiping for you too. Avoid the game memory wiping you too.
Hopefully Cole took rigorous notes. Come on.
The it's about fashion playwrights,
yeah,
who are
it's about
theater kids gone wild.
Yeah,
that is who you're fighting,
and not in the fun way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
Whatever. A lot of the individual things got alighted for me as well, even as it is like the individual details, and part of it was a property of the game, and then part of it was just not understanding a lot of the jokes and things that would probably add additional meaning, you know, to some of these beats.
Jason writes, and this is the final Mystical Ninja response, Goemon 64 is one of my favorite N64 games, and it's also undeniably a 7 out of 10. This isn't a damning statement about Goemon, though, just a reflection of how much the N64 sucked. My family bought an N64 because, quote, the last Nintendo was fine. And the years that followed felt like karmic punishment, especially as a Mario Kart and Ocarina of Time non-enjoyer. It was especially brutal as a Konami fan. My friends with PlayStations were experiencing Symphony of the Night for the first time, while I was renting Hybrid Heaven. Oh dear.
Yeah, this is really sad. This whole thing is very bleak.
I want to adopt you.
Yeah.
While I was renting Hybrid Heaven from the video store and desperately trying to convince myself it was, quote, basically as good as Metal Gear, the previous Nintendo was fine. Yeah. Goemon 64 wasn't something I could lord over my friends in PlayStation land, but it was playful and novel and didn't wear out its welcome. And since I had barely seen any anime, most of the tropes it was playing with felt genuinely exotic and cool. I beat it in a weekend or two and had a mostly good time. Then, after several months weighing my options, I sold my N64. After all, I thought, I can always buy a used one when Mother 3 comes out.
Womp womp.
Keep the dreams alive. Yeah. Good Lord.
The whole thing's real sad.
Hey, Charlie Brown. Yeah, like, are you okay?
No notes. Largely agree. Man, looking at libraries, Nintendo 64 is rough compared to the PlayStation.
Yeah.
And
there are probably people who will see that as being like a console warrior, like partisan kind of thing, even still to this day.
Yeah.
No.
I have no dog in that race. Like I'm going through and being a smug asshole and going, at the time I was playing computer games, you know, like,
this is Country Mouse and City Mouse teaming up to kick the shit out of College Town Mouse.
I'm College Town Mouse. You know, so yeah, don't think that this is console warrior stuff. Just in retrospect, like, criminy. It is a night and day library.
Yeah. Those Micro Machines games were cool.
They're fine. They're some fine games. Got a lot of use out of Nintendo 64, but it wasn't like PlayStation.
No.
And also just PlayStation hitting when I was still very into console RPGs.
Oh yeah.
Like I'm gonna play Grandia on Jade Cocoon. You know, I'm not gonna play any of these dog shit games.
Yeah.
Like,
fuck you, put it in my veins.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't a thing where what I wanted then it had, and what I wanted now it has compared. Yeah. Moving on to Dragon Quest IV responses. Michael says, I love Dragon Quest. There's something about getting an eclectic group of adventurers and a wagon together and journeying through forest, mountain, and desert to complete small vignettes that climax in killing a demon lord that is so comfy. The party chat, removed in the DS version, adds to the sense of adventure, with your team slowly showing development as they provide feedback on otherwise inconsequential NPC chat or plot developments. There's something to me about this older style of slow burn JRPG, still giving your imagination room to fill in the gaps of what the developers provide to the player. I hope that you enjoy your time with the game and consider giving Dragon Quest V a go in the future as well. I did not enjoy my time very much. It was fine. I didn't hate it, but I did enjoy it and probably will not do Dragon Quest V for reasons that will be clear in the episode. It is not personal.
Yep. It's personal.
Yeah. It's personal directly to you, Michael.
Lone Lizard says, hello, WAF crew. I just listened to the first part of your review of Dragon Quest IV. Happy to see you cover one of my favorite RPGs off of the DS. Even while my math brain disagrees with some of your criticisms, there are methods to cut down on the grinding. I'll always appreciate critiques from outside my little bubble. I doubly appreciate dropping the term JRPG like a hot potato for console RPG, even if my other favorite DS RPG, the Blobber Etrian Odyssey, still remains as an edge case. That brings me to my $1,000 question. Considering that Baldur's Gate 3 is the big thing at the moment, how would you pitch/sell to those people, or Dragon Quest to those people? The latest one, because I'm not a monster. Sketch out the Baldur's Gate 3 to Dragon Quest 11 pipeline. Can't.
Yeah, I don't know what that, like, they're so fundamentally different as things.
Yeah.
There's no overlap. Like none of these things are qualitative statements. I mean these all descriptive. Like I have my preferences, and I don't want anyone to attach qualitativeness to me because they know my preferences. But Dragon Quest games are not tactical. Like they're not trying to be. It's okay. That's not what they want to be. They're linear stories that are focused on being quaint, where you do not have control over the plot. You have very little control over your build. The tactical considerations tend to be very, very minimal. You know, it is a couple of debuffs and then making sure you have enough supplies before you leave a town. That is night and day. I have no idea how you would make that change, you know. The console RPGs that I like more, that I actually like, and I also love Baldur's Gate 3, they have more of that in common.
Yeah.
You know, they have a tactical angle, like your Final Fantasy 12s have this like gambit system that is interesting, or your Final Fantasy Tactics, which have tactical combat. I just cannot imagine it. The thing about console RPG versus JRPG, like I am in favor of that because it makes fewer people call me racist. The tricky part is console also begins with C. So like they're both CRPG, which is part of why, and also see the question we had in this dispatch about playing CRPGs on a console. None of them are active, you know. And then also see the question we got about Chained Echoes, which is a console RPG but not from a Japanese developer. In perfect terms for it. I just don't want people to call me racist because I don't like certain video games.
I heard it, you know, when that discourse was out. I had heard compelling enough arguments to be like, hey, this is a small change you can make. People will still know what you're saying, and it is, you know, more inclusive, and also to a degree a little bit more accurate, because there are those styles of games that come out of the West too, you know. Like I can see the argument for keeping it in place, but it is, you know, to me a minor enough change what we call things.
It's not hard. It's no burden. It doesn't solve it, which is my only hang up with it. You know, it doesn't fix it. It's just, it's a slightly closer, you know, to it, but it's also, I don't know. It's tough. But yeah, it makes people stop yelling at me, which I love. Moving on here, we have a question here from Katie, or a response from Katie. Katie says, I lived in Dragon Quest IV. I was 2 years old when I arrived in North America, and while many of my memories of youth are faded, thanks ADHD, I can say with some confidence that this was my first RPG. I remember sitting on the couch watching my older sister fighting slimes and babbles, absolutely enchanted by the music and the story. We had a folded poster of the game world map labeled on one side, and the other side had a chart of every item in the game, complete with weapon stats and equipable characters. Another poster had every spell and monster, Both of these had been opened and folded and refolded and worn and repaired so that they were like faded treasure maps, almost unreadable at the creases. Mm. I can't be objective about this game. It's probably foundational to the way to my brain, the way Final Fantasy VI would be a few years later. I remember when I was old enough to play it myself, my delight at the choice of having a female lead and then proceeding to make an all-woman team to fight evil, which gave me unrealistic standards for the gender parity in every single RPG I've played since then. Also, I love Alina. She's my favorite. Talun is very good, but he's no Kung Fu Death Princess. My one regret about the DS version, aside from missing party chat, is that Alina's unique critical hit formula was tweaked so she doesn't reach her horrifying 25% crit rate until level 90. Just give her the stiletto earrings and watch her carve the enemy to pieces. Anyway, I love Dragon Quest, Dragon Quest/Warrior 4, and listening to any part of its soundtracks awakens me like a sleeper agent.
All of those are very sweet stories.
Yeah.
And you know, my underwhelm with the series in general would not cause me to take that away from you for all the world. Mm-mm. So
no, that's very sweet.
Yes, especially, you know, bonding with your family over it. And you know, I couldn't help but go when I heard about the map that was, you know, folded and refolded and worn so much that looked like an old treasure map, you know. Yeah. Just any well-loved feely, you know?
Yeah, fun artifact of old-time gamey.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
And also Alina rules.
Yeah.
David writes, Dragon Quest is like comfort food. I know what I'm getting, and I want it the same way every time. Having played all the other Dragon Quest games, I kind of hesitated to play Dragon Quest IV because of the way the game was divided into chapters. But I was pleasantly surprised to find it pretty enjoyable when I took it for a spin last year. Each chapter had a vibe with a simple objective. The musical variety was enjoyable for an 8-bit era RPG with different themes and music per chapter. So I didn't hate the AI party system as much as I thought I would. It sure opened up the game to a few surprises at the end. Ultimately, I'm not sure the game accomplished what Yuji Horii wanted, but I think it was a stepping stone toward other successful entries in the series. I would argue Dragon Quest IV is the iterative culmination of all the previous Dragon Quests during the Famicom era. It's not the best one, but pretty good. Fun fact, you can change the overworld music by swapping different characters to the front in the last chapter. I did not know that. I always kept the hero at the front.
Yeah, that also felt like the way it felt canonical.
Yeah.
You know, to me. It's interesting how many of the responses have to do with music. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of my things that is like one of the secrets to nostalgia of console RPGs is just music.
Yep.
You know, I think that is a there's some truth to that. Like, not saying that that's the only reason why people feel like, you know, reason people like them, but.
Yeah. It is an achievement, right?
Yeah.
To compose songs that are so affecting that it sways you even years later. Like, I don't know. That's impressive.
Yeah. It's impressive. It's just, it's music. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It reminds me of the cutscene conversation. It's not game design. It's music. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I might think of that differently because of making music. I don't know.
Yeah.
Naveen says, I'm currently playing Dragon Quest IV, the DS version, to follow along with the show. The series has always been a blind spot for me, and I'm glad to have finally sampled this legendary franchise. That being said, boy, am I not very impressed. The combat is shallow, the story is a big nothing, the characters are, well, simply archetypes uttering the most rote lines. This is what brought the Japanese economy to a standstill on release day? I understand that this was an NES game, but even so, it's pretty bare bones. I enjoyed the Torneko chapter for what it was, but aside from that, I can't say that I'm loving my time with it. I'll still probably finish it, just to say I did, but I think I can leave this franchise in the not-for-me pile. Out of curiosity, do subsequent entries get any better? My understanding is that the series is very conservative and that Dragon Quest XI is not very different from its predecessor. What say you? Is there a Dragon Quest that isn't as grindy and pointless as this one? Yeah. Like, they get easier, and they get, mm-hmm. like, easier in terms of, like, ease of use. Like, Dragon Quest VIII is a more polished version of this. It's mm-hmm. a lot longer, but it's more charming. It's prettier. And Dragon Quest XI, I believe people when they say that is, like, the absolute apotheosis. Charm and polish for this level of simplicity.
Yeah.
If the idea of it being super grindy And not having good dialogue is what you don't like about it. You might like 11 or 8. If the idea is that it's very simple is what you don't like about it, it will still be very simple.
Yeah.
They are just simple games.
Yeah. You know, it might just be like, you know, that thing that you don't like is inherent to what this is. It's like, you know, to take the comfort food example, it's a, you know, like, oh man, would I like this mac and cheese if I am both lactose intolerant and also, you know, gluten sensitive?
Yeah. Like, you know, it is a comfort thing, you know, and there might be versions of it that are gluten free and are lactose free, but you don't like mac and cheese.
Yeah.
You know, so it would really depend, I think.
Mm-hmm. Aaron writes, as an autistic person, I occasionally find myself overwhelmed by sensory stimuli. A couple of things that help me overcome the struggle are repetitive actions and comforting sounds or visuals. Whether mainline entries or one of the many spectacular spin-off series, Dragon Quest fills this niche perfectly for me. Whilst it might seem like hyperbole, this is one of a handful of series that makes a genuine difference in my life by allowing me to recharge my batteries before reaching a non-functional state. All that said, I realize that the series isn't for everyone, and many will be put off by the grind-heavy play and traditional JRPG narrative, which is especially true of 4. For that reason, it's hard to recommend any of the mainline entries to modern audiences or those fatigued with the genre. I personally find it more useful to present Dragon Quest IV and the series as a whole through the lens of my neurodiversity to give an indication of whether it might appeal to others or not. I myself have a lot of affection for Dragon Quest IV. Its sense of humor regularly gives me a chuckle, and I find it a vibrant setting to be in, especially the DS version. I don't know if it adds much originality to the series, but I find it a perfect encapsulation of what Dragon Quest is and an absolute joy to play.
Nice.
I am, again, happy that it fills that role for you and makes your life better. Like, that rules.
Yeah, I cannot, you know, we can only have the experience we have with stuff. Like, I, you know, I suffer from depression and anxiety. I don't know where I verge on neuro, you know, how you describe it, but it is different than that. I'm not autistic to my knowledge. I don't have those exact needs. Like, I'll do other things when I need to. You know, if I'm anxious or if I'm having that thing, like, other things will fulfill that. But I love hearing from other people who are getting that from different places.
Yeah.
You know, it is broadening.
Yeah. And anything that fills your meters, as long as it doesn't hurt somebody.
As long as it doesn't take away somebody else's meter.
Yes.
You know, in kind of a general sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's announce our stuff. Let's do our thing.
Let's do. So we already know next month's games, which are going to be Castlevania Aria of Sorrow, the Pokemon trading card game, which rules, by the way. And the premium episode is Doom Eternal. If you have thoughts about those, go to duckv.tv/contact and write in by September the 15th. Also, if you have things to say about Lisa, we'll include some of those as well. We're coming up on the most wonderful time of the year, which is October, where we do all horror games.
Yeah. And October is also, weather's perfect. You know, everything's great about October, including the games we're doing, which include, Amnesia the Bunker, Dredge, as we mentioned earlier, alluded to. And then our premium episode for that month is Signalis.
Yeah. I have not played Dredge. That's one of those ones that I had intended to stream until Gary mentioned doing it for the show. But the other two, I fucking love. Amnesia the Bunker, basically, I had to fast track it after I played it earlier this year because I think Gary is going to be enamored with it.
Nice. I love being enamored. I mean, a horror month is an easy sell for me. Even when I don't like it, I like it. Like, even when it's kind of like, oh, this is all right. It's still fun because spooky shit. Way into it. That is going to be October 15th is the deadline there. If you would like to hear those premium episodes, if you'd like to sponsor an episode, things like that, you can do so by becoming a patron. $5 a month gets you the premium episodes. That is at patreon.com/duckfeedtv. if you are a non-straight, non-white, non-cis, non-male person, and you have a project you'd like us to shout out, please send me an email at gary@duckfeed.tv. This episode, I want to talk about the Strange Library podcast, which is a podcast that does kind of weird fiction, short story literature podcast. So they do synopsises and discussions of short stories and odd picks from the strange corners of the library. So that is what I would like to shout out. That is Leroy's project and sounds cool.
Yeah, that is at strangelibrarypod.com. A weird fiction book club. I love it.
Yeah, nice idea. Absolutely. So send me an email if you have anything like that. I include a short pitch, pronunciation, pronouns, things like that are all very useful. You can also leave a rating or review for this podcast on the podcast directory of your choice. And big thanks to Gwen.
Yeah, thank you, Gwen, for helping us put these episodes together.
Yeah, Gwen, Gwen, Gwen,
Gwen,
Gwen,
Gwen,
Gwen,
Gwen,
Gwen,
Gwen, Gwen.
We'll see you next week with Aria of Sorrow.
We will.